I was just telling people at the front, someone said, oh, not more Fourier transforms. Yes, more Fourier transforms. But the principle we're trying to get across to you is, you know, that is one of averaging. You know, you average things, you increase the signal, and you reduce the noise. And we're applying that to teaching as well. So, you know, we're telling you things three or four different ways, and each lecturer has a sort of residual amount of noise in the lecture. And so you average all the lectures, and you get the signal in the end. So I just wanted to... This kind of be short and hopefully fun. I just wanted to go through a few things about Fourier transforms, which will elaborate on some of the things that Michael Moody talked about. So I'm going to put up, you know, objects and their Fourier transforms and talk a little bit about the relationship between real space and reciprocal space. And you know, this it may seem sort of redundant, but it's very important that you begin to think about that relationship and begin to think in reciprocal space, because you're dealing with objects in many cases in reciprocal space, so you need to know the sort of transformations that you can do, and that will help you in designing your algorithms for image processing. So just a note about sort of terminology. We're pretty sloppy in our how we refer to real space or reciprocal space. So I just listed some of the things that you'll come across. Real space, reciprocal space. Real space is also, we refer to it as the image or the object. In signal processing, it's called the time domain or the spatial domain. And over on the other side, in reciprocal space, we variously call it the transform, Fourier space, diffraction space, or the frequency domain. And there's this sort of distinction between the Fourier transform and the optical diffraction pattern, what I'll be showing you today are optical diffraction patterns. And they're not exactly the Fourier transform. They're related to the Fourier transform. If you square the amplitude of the Fourier transform, you get an intensity distribution, which is what you see in the laser, which is the optical diffraction pattern. And the diffraction, that intensity distribution is what X-ray crystallographers collect because they have no, they don't have phases. So most of these examples are from a book called Atlas of Fourier Transforms, which is out of print, but it's a very useful and fun book to have. It has about 20 or 30 plates like this on facing pages. And it's usually, you know, real space here and reciprocal space over there. And each panel has its corresponding diffraction pattern. This one is the one over there. And it's kind of fun to go through it. There are very brief explanations at the back in English and in French. But it's an incredibly useful book to have around. Amazon.com have a few copies, secondhand copies, which are much more expensive than they were originally, but they're well worth it. Sorry. So I just want to start off looking at a few objects here and how the difference in the size and the sort of distribution of objects in real space is related to what you see in Fourier space or in the intensity distribution of the Fourier transform. So we start up here with a spot, and as you come down here in these three panels, the spot gets larger. And remember the reciprocal nature of Fourier space. The corresponding diffraction pattern over here, which is an airy disk, this, if you take a line through the center of this spot, it's that top hat function in two dimensions that Michael was referring to. And you take a line over here, and what you get is a sync function. So it's a rotationally symmetric sync function with a large central peak, and then fringes coming out from that. So that's the optical diffraction pattern of that spot. Now, if you increase the size of the spot, so things in real space are getting bigger, so things in reciprocal space are inversely related, and they begin to shrink in. So the central spot reduces in size from something that's that diameter to that diameter, and these fringes also reduce correspondingly in size. Again, down here, bigger again. So small, medium, large, large, medium, small, just emphasizing that reciprocal nature. And then we have the idea of convolution. So sort of this is a convolution of that point, that spot, with 2 points. So in reciprocal space, we have a multiplication of the molecular transform, or the molecular diffraction pattern, if you like, with the diffraction pattern from 2 points, which is a set of lines running vertically. And you can see that the molecular transform is really sampled by this transform of the 2 points. And the spacing between the 2 points is inversely related, as you can see in these two examples here, inversely related to what you see in reciprocal space. So here, the points are close together. There's a wide spacing between these fringes. Here, the points are far apart, and there's a narrow spacing between those fringes. And as you come down the page in this set of 9, the same operation is repeated with the medium-sized spot and the large spot. So here you see them very close together. The molecular transform is the same. You can, if you blur your eyes, these three panels basically look the same. It's just the sampling of that molecular transform that changes. And note that the spacing here is the same as the spacing between points here. The spacing between fringes here is the same as the spacing between fringes here, and so on over. The fringe spacing is the same over here. And the same with the large spot, which in fact overlaps. But again, the spacing between fringes is the same. And again here. Down here is a slight variation. Instead of looking at a circle, we're looking at a rectangle. And this has sharp edges, both vertically and horizontally. So the fringes will be concentrated in these spikes in the transform, in the vertical direction and in the horizontal direction. The rectangle is tall and quite narrow, so the inverse relationship over here in the vertical direction in the optical diffraction pattern, the dimension is small and large in the horizontal direction. And again, we've spaced them, or they've spaced them the same distance apart here as in the rows above them. And you can see the effect. Again, there's this sort of sampling, which is the same spacing as you see all the way here. And again, very fine sampling over here, exactly the same as you see in the circular example. I'm continuing the tradition here that was established on day one, that the slides do not correspond to the handout. Just a few more examples of spots. So here, the effect of orientation. So we have a single spot again, slightly different representation of the optical diffraction pattern. You don't see the fringes here very well, but in fact they are there. Two spots at an angle, and again the fringes are in this direction, slightly more shallow angle. Again the fringes are at right angles to that. And again, the idea of the spacing between the points is reciprocally related to the spacing between the fringes. Here we have a group of 4. So really, if you took that and rotated the object here by about 30 degrees, you'd have the points going horizontally, and you would rotate the transform the same amount by about 30 degrees, and you would have those fringes going vertically. And the combination of this object and this rotated object, if you add them together in a sequence, will give you this. And similarly over here, addition in real space is the same as addition in reciprocal space. You have that rotated transform added with this one to give you this set of fringes here. Now, here is a sort of departure from the square lattice, or the square idea of thinking. Here is something that's threefold symmetric and something that's sixfold symmetric, and their corresponding diffraction patterns over here. And you'll see that the threefold symmetric thing gives a power spectrum which is sixfold symmetric, as does the sixfold symmetric object over here gives a power spectrum which is sixfold symmetric. Now, if you only saw the diffraction pattern, you would not be able to tell whether that's something with threefold symmetry or something with sixfold symmetry. However, if you had the Fourier transform, you would have the amplitudes and phases, and you would be able to distinguish immediately. And that's due to a property called centrosymmetry. So what centrosymmetry means is that if you go to an axis on an object, and travel out in one direction, say vertically, and travel out in the exactly the opposite direction, if the object is centrosymmetric, you will encounter exactly the same things. So starting in the center here, going out, you hit the blob. In the opposite direction, going out, you hit the blob. You'll have the same relationship in the transform over here, in terms of both the amplitude and the phase. Starting in the center, going out, you will hit a blob here with a certain phase. And going out in the other direction, you'll hit a blob of amplitude in the transform here, which will have exactly the same phase. So this transform from a six-fold symmetric object is six-fold symmetric. So amplitude and phase here is exactly the same as amplitude and phase here, is the same as 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 here. The other property of transforms of centrosymmetric objects is that the transform is real, and that means that all the phases are either 0 or 180 degrees. So this object can be represented as an additive series of cosine waves. In contrast, this object cannot. You have to have a combination of sines and cosine waves to reconstruct this object, because it does not exhibit centrosymmetry. So if you start in the center and go out here, you hit a blob. You start in the center and go out in exactly the opposite direction, you don't hit a blob. And you see the same thing in the computed Fourier transform, but not in this diffraction pattern. You start here, you go out in this direction, you hit an island of amplitude, and it will have a certain phase, which will not be the same as the phase over here. So this object has to be reconstructed with both sines and cosine waves. The phases here will not be 0 or 180. They can vary through a wide range of values. So here's the idea of distortion. So here we have a rather similar object to what you saw on the previous page. Six spots arranged in a circle. And here's the corresponding power spectrum. Now if we take this object and we compress it vertically to get this, compression in real space is equivalent to expansion in reciprocal space. So you can see that this blob here, corresponding to that one, is no longer circular, but is stretched out in the horizontal direction. Another example here, instead we've compressed it basically in the vertical direction, so the transform up here is expanded in the vertical direction. And down at the bottom, rather more severe, we've done it at an angle now. But, actually, the thing has been rotated and squashed, and the transform has been, you can imagine it having been rotated and expanded in the direction of the compression here. Now that's one way of looking at that in terms of distortion. But if we instead imagine that this is a three-dimensional object, so instead of little circles here, we have little spheres here in three dimensions, what you will have is a three-dimensional transform over here, which is the same as it comes out of the page. Okay? So we're now imagining this in three dimensions, spheres here, and a three-dimensional transform over here, which is continuous in this direction. Now instead of compressing it, let's imagine that we're taking the object and we're tilting it. So the whole thing is tilting out of the plane of the screen. And in projection, what you see is this, and I've told you how you get that by the simple expansion and contraction in real space, reciprocal space and real space. But if we imagine it as a three-dimensional object being tilted, the three-dimensional transform will be tilted, but what we're viewing in a projection is a central section through that three-dimensional transform. So tilt this transform and all those bars of amplitude which are coming directly out of the screen go off to the side, and then you're cutting a slice through that three-dimensional transform here, and you can then see how the expansion can be explained in terms of a three-dimensional object. And this sort of idea, this tilting idea, will come up again in Vincenzo's talk, where you collect data for three-dimensional crystals, or two-dimensional crystals. So that's a tilt in that direction, and you can yourselves think about how that would be done by a tilt, and how that would be done by a rotation and a tilt, and what would happen to the three-dimensional transforms in each case. Just another example of distortion or tilting, if you like, a rather odd-shaped object, and its power spectrum down here. In the center, it's like squashing the thing in, and then squashing it much further. And you can see that the features in the transform are the same, but they're being expanded in reciprocal space as there is compression in real space. This is the idea of building up a lattice, again, the sort of convolution operation. We start off with a single circle and its power spectrum over here. And again, we're just showing that sort of central peak. We're not really seeing the fringes on the outside. The exposure is not too good. In the vertical direction here, we're seeing what happens to this, the molecular transform, if you like, as it's sampled by this sort of point light function, which is a line of points of various numbers. So here we have 2 points. A couple of slides back, you saw what happens there. You get this sort of fringe effect, which samples the molecular transform. Add some more, the fringes become sharper. You can see in here some subsidiary peaks. So there's a large sort of peak here, and then there's a subsidiary peak. And as you add more and more, the subsidiary peaks also increase in number, but they get lower and lower in amplitude, so that if you extended this line of points infinitely in the vertical direction, you would have very sharp diffraction here, or very sharp sampling of the molecular transform at the inverse spacing here. So then we just build it up the same way in the horizontal direction. You get sampling with some fringes in between, more fringes over there becoming somewhat more attenuated, and keep adding up until we get essentially a two-dimensional crystal down here, and you get a two-dimensional lattice, which is sampling the molecular transform. So again, if you sort of blur your eyes, throw your eyes out of focus, and look at this whole page, basically what you should see is that the overall distribution of intensity here is the same as the overall distribution of intensity here. As I explained, we're not really seeing this fringe up here because of the exposure problems and the reproduction. Again, another example. So the object here is a tiny hexagon. Actually, there are two tiny hexagons there sitting on the side by side. Here, they're a sort of angle to each other. Here, they're stacked up on top of each other. And here, they're in a two-dimensional lattice. So we again have the sort of sampling idea of the molecular transform. So the molecular transform would be the transform of a single repeating unit. And again, blur your eyes and you can see that it consists of, it's a hexagon, so that there's a large peak in the center and then these big peaks of intensity around it, which are exactly the same amplitude and phase. Because there are two, it's sampled. You see these fringes. The fringe direction changes as the positions of the two hexagons change with each other. So here they're running in this direction. The sampling runs in this direction. Here it almost looks like a helical diffraction pattern. They're stacked on top of each other. So there are lots of repeating units in the vertical direction. So the sampling is very sharp in the vertical direction of the transform. There are only two repeating units in the horizontal direction. So the sampling in the horizontal direction is actually the same as the sampling in the horizontal direction here. Over here, we have this two-dimensional crystal. So we have spots sampling the molecular transform. Again, just blur your eyes and you can see that the overall intensity distribution here is the same as the overall intensity distribution here. Now these are helices. This is a helix built up of a line. This is the same line on which there are, I can't even see them up here, on which there are points along the line at a quite large spacing, and here it's the same line as this one, but the points are very close together. So at low resolution, these look the same. So you have, blur your eyes, forget about the fact that there are points along here. You have a helix, you have a helix, you have a helix. And at low resolution, these transforms are the same, exactly the same. It's only when you get to the higher resolution areas of the transform where there's a difference. Note also that basically this helix in projection looks like a series of lines which are angled like that, and the ones from the other side of the helix which are angled like that. So it's like having two diffraction gratings sitting on top of each other, rotated with respect to each other. So those lines give diffraction in this direction, and they give that in the diffraction pattern, and these lines give diffraction in that direction, and they give that in the diffraction pattern. Now when you start to sample along the helix, this is high resolution information, you get lots of spots out here, and the finer the sampling, the more detailed, the finer the spacing of the spots in real space, the more detailed information that you need at high resolution or reciprocal space to define that very well. So this is a helix with a short pitch. Where is it? Here's a helix with a somewhat longer pitch. So again, one side of the helix is like a series of fringes like that. The other side is a series of fringes like that. And again, you see the diffraction is thrown out at right angles to those sort of low resolution fringes, as it were. Again, here it's a line. Here it's points spaced quite far apart. Here it's points spaced very closely together. At low resolution, they look the same, exactly the same amplitude and phase distribution at low resolution, because at low resolution, all three look like a line. It's only when you start adding detail to the helix that you start getting a requirement for this high resolution information out here to define where those points are on the helix. So I want to talk a little bit about filtering, the effect of having limited data, low-pass filtering and high-pass filtering. Again, just some examples from this book. And you'll see that there's a difference between what I'm showing you here and what you have in your handout. And that's because last night as I was looking at this, going over what I was going to say, I found that I couldn't explain what was going on here. It's either a mistake or there's something that I'm not... that's not explained very well in the book, but these did not make sense to me, so I just blocked them out completely. So what we're dealing with here is a crystal of this repeating unit, which is some organic molecule whose name I've forgotten. And that crystal gives this diffraction pattern over here. So what we're going to do is to see what happens when you restrict the amount of data from the diffraction pattern or the Fourier transform that you use to calculate the final image. So here's all the diffraction data, amplitudes and phases out to high resolution, and you can see that the object is defined very well. Here's what it should look like at atomic resolution, but here's the resolution to this study. So it looks pretty good. You know, you could fit the polypeptide chain there or whatever it is. Now let's do a low-pass filter, so let's throw away everything outside a certain radius. And this can be done easily computationally just by using these spots to calculate the final image, or in the optical bench, you know, if you have a laser diffractometer set up where you can look at the diffraction pattern and then reconstruct an image, you would simply put in a mask to blank out all the spots out there. So again, limited resolution here. What do you get? You get something that looks pretty much like the object, but there are, you know, it's a sort of overview of it. It's what you get if you blur your eyes and look at this. So here are the some of the primary spots in the diffraction pattern. So that spot and its Friedel mate over here, just two spots that you're allowing through the mask, or two spots, two Fourier component, or actually a single Fourier component and its Friedel mate that you're using to calculate something in real space. And one Fourier component gives you a wave of density which is traveling out in the direction of the Fourier component lies with respect to the origin. Again, this Fourier component is somewhat further out from the origin, so it's a wave which is going faster and at a different angle. Here we have the center. This one's at a different angle again, so you get this sort of wave of mass in real space. So really, the electron microscopists, we're all trying to get there, and if we're lucky, we get there, and if we're really unlucky, we just get that, and that tells you nothing about the final object. So you really need to have a lot of data to have some sort of meaningful thing in real space. Just high-pass filtering. So this is the object down here, and I'm not quite sure what it is. It looks like a map. But anyway, it's a series of lines with some dots in it, and here's the optical diffraction pattern, or the calculated Fourier transform representation of the amplitudes. And so if we were to block out the center of that, throw the data that's in the center away, and only use the high-resolution information to reconstruct the object, which is what you have over here. They put a mask in the optical bench to block out the center of the diffraction pattern, and then recombine these data to form a map. What you get are just the high-resolution information about the structure. So you don't get any information about the fact that this is bright in the middle. Here's this big spot in real space, and the information that tells you that this is bright is really in here, close to the center of the transform. So we're throwing that away. But these high-resolution features, these fine lines, are recorded out here in Fourier space, and so we're not doing anything for those. We're using those to go back and reconstruct what's called a high-pass filtered image. One of these classical examples of high and low pass filtering, Mickey Mouse, with high resolution features like fingers and a belt and a pointed tail. And this is the diffraction pattern. Again, this was carried out on a laser bench, so they put a mask in to only allow the low resolution Fourier components to contribute to the image. And you get a low resolution view of Mickey Mouse. You don't see any high resolution features. You don't see his fingers. You don't see the belt, you don't see the sort of pointed tail. Everything is sort of smeared out. Now if you do the sort of inverse of that and you block out the center of the transform, throw away all the low resolution information, only use the high resolution information, you just get the outline. You do get the outline of the fingers. You get all the edges, which are high resolution information. Oops. Again, another example of low-pass filtering. Here is the object down here. Here is its diffraction pattern up here. And we're throwing away progressively higher and higher resolution information. So you lose, and when you reconstruct the image from only this part of the diffraction pattern, you begin to sort of fuzz out the details. So here's a low-resolution view, not very detailed. You get an overall picture of the general distribution, but you don't get the idea that this is made up of discrete points. Carrying that on to even an extreme case, restricting the amount of low-resolution information even further, it begins to blur out even more, right? The very lowest resolution Fourier components here are contributing to the reconstructed image. You just get a general idea of where the blobs are, and again, very tiny part of the transform contributing to the image, you just get these fringes. Here's just an example that Nigel Unwin and I did many, many years ago, which we thought was quite interesting, but we never found any use for it. This is a picture of a thin section through an oocyte of a lizard in which ribosomes had crystallized on membranes. So here's a ribosome crystal here. Between this ribosome crystal and that one below it, which is just seen here in sort of glancing section, there's a membrane. And then between this ribosome crystal and the one below that, there's another membrane. So we did this on an optical bench. And so you put this in the laser, then you go to the back focal plane where the diffraction pattern is, and you make a mask that, which was just a glass plate with some dots on it, and the dots blocked out the discrete diffraction from this particular ribosome crystal, so it prevented the information from this crystal from passing on down the optical bench and being reconstructed into an image. Then when we did reconstruct the image, you can see that essentially this crystal, you get the extent of it pretty well, has completely disappeared from the image, the reconstructed image, and basically you get a sort of view of the membrane underneath. Okay, a couple of things, or just really one thing that I wanted to say about computed transforms, which however many times it's told to you, it's never told to you enough, because many people continue to make the sort of mistakes which are associated with this misconception. So here we have an image, a digital image, say for example, which is 128 by 128 pixels, and each pixel is 5 angstroms by 5 angstroms. So essentially in real space, this is 640 angstroms by 640 angstroms. Now you calculate a Fourier transform from that, you get an array of amplitudes and phases, and the array is, like the image, 128 by 128. Now, how are the relationships here related to the spatial relationships over here? Well, to reconstruct this object, the Fourier series tells us is that you need the sort of fundamental frequency, which is the largest spacing of the object, and then components of that. So the largest spacing in this object is this, from one edge of the array that's being transformed to the other edge, which is 640 angstroms. Now, where does that come in the computed Fourier transform? Well, that's the spacing of the first pixel out from the origin of the Fourier transform. So the first pixel out is at a reciprocal spacing of 1 over 640 angstroms. So you really don't need to worry about that if you're doing square transforms all the time, because the dimension in reciprocal space over here in this direction is the same as the dimensions in reciprocal space in this direction. So the transform and the image are sort of symmetric in that respect. The problem comes when you try to save time and space because you don't want to transform a large square image with nothing in half of it, and you transform an image which is 64 by 128. So then things change in the calculated Fourier transform, because the spacing in the vertical direction is still 640 angstroms, which, as I've told you, corresponds to the first pixel out from the center in the vertical direction. However, that's different from the spacing in the Fourier transform in the horizontal direction, because the horizontal direction is only 320 angstroms. So the first pixel out from the origin in the horizontal direction is 1 over 320 angstroms. So although your real space image has the dimensions or has the scale the same in both directions, because you're doing a transform which is not square, things get distorted here and things get sort of compressed in the horizontal direction. All the information is there. You're not losing any information at all. It's just squashed into a smaller space in the horizontal direction. Okay. Now you know all about Fourier transforms. So now I'm going to give the students a test to see if you've been listening. So I want the students to sort of tell me something about the real space object of which this is the optical diffraction pattern. And I had prizes. Okay, before we start, hands up the vegetarians. You need the energy. And you're going to need it tonight too because it's a barbecue. Here, have another one. Okay. Come on, shout out. What can you tell me about the object here, or objects? Two dots horizontally? You're not a student. Vertically. Here. I heard two verticals over there. And is the dot large or small? Small. There are too many smalls there. I'm keeping these. Okay, two dots vertically. All right. What's the optical diffraction pattern of that? Who said that? What's the difference between the computed Fourier transform of that and the computed Fourier transform of that? God damn it! What's the object? Who said hard to say? He's right. Why? It could be threefold or six. How can we tell? Let's say we have the computer transform and the phase here is zero, and the phase here is zero, and the phase here is zero. Can you tell? Phase here is zero, phase here is zero. Yes, what? Over there. Okay, that one was three, actually. What about this one? No, you were right. I had forgotten I had another slide. Okay, this is the same sort of thing. You can't really tell whether this is threefold or sixfold until you really look at the phases. I get one for that. All right. 128 by 128 digital image computed Fourier transform. We're looking at the power spectrum. What is the corresponding computed transform of this? Keep them quiet. Okay, what does the transform look like? Compressed? Okay, who says it's going to be compressed in this direction? Okay, I guess that didn't go in when I was telling you about it. Now, let's forget for a moment that we were talking about computed transforms. Let's say you put that in the laser and you put that in the laser. You get this. Now, if you compute it, you have this sort of limitation that what's in... how can I explain this? All right, I got it. What you have to imagine is that you're not computing the Fourier transform of this, but you're computing the Fourier transform of a crystal, which this is the repeating unit in. Okay? So imagine you have these lined up side by side in all directions, horizontally and vertically, and now you have a crystal of this motif. Okay? Do the same thing with that. Extend that as far as you can horizontally and extend it as far as you can vertically in these little squares, and you have a crystal. Okay, so the repeating unit up here is the molecular transform of that crystal is whatever that object is there. So the molecular transform will look something like that. Now the molecular transform of this object is much more squashed in that direction. He's smiling. He's like sitting back there thinking, he's not doing a good job here. They're all looking at him blankly. Yes. Yeah. But if you think about it in terms of what the spacings are in the computed transform, the largest spacing horizontally, which is the extent of the box, is also is reciprocally related to the first pixel out horizontally in the transform. So if you always remember that, largest spacing horizontally, first pixel out horizontally in the transform, largest spacing vertically, first pixel out vertically in the transform. Just that's all you have to remember, you can never go wrong. Okay, what's that? Who said small dot? You're not a student. What's that? Blur your eyes. What does the molecular transform look like? Large circle. Basically, the molecular transform is the same as on the previous slide, which is a sort of large circle like this. So the repeating unit is a small dot. Small dot. Okay, small dot, but how many of them are there vertically? Are there lots or are there a few? Lots. How many of them are there horizontally? So the diffraction vertically is very sharp, which means that there are many repeating units vertically. The diffraction horizontally is very broad, which means that there are actually few of them horizontally. And it's a little helix of dots. What's the object? Helix? What kind of helix? Continuous helix or a sample helix? Sample helix.
Whoa!
You get the prize. Are you in my practical? Helical practical? Who wants to do the helical practical? Okay, it's a helix, yeah. And did someone say it was sampled or unsampled? I mean, are there dots? Is it a continuous helix? Is it a line, or are there dots along the line? Dots. There aren't many answers down there. It's actually a double helix, but I don't think you'd be able to tell that from the diffraction pattern alone. Okay, so this is a diffraction pattern, small central peak with some fringes around it. What's the object? Big circle. You get the prize too. This is a diffraction pattern. Blur your eyes. What's the molecular transform of? Six? Who said six-fold symmetry? Over here somewhere. You? No? He's a meat eater. You're right. Okay, could be six, could be three. Caught me out there. Okay, but so the repeating unit is 6 or 3/4 symmetric, and what's the arrangement? Crystal? What kind of crystal? Square lattice? Hexagonal lattice? Hexagonal lattice. Very good. There you go.
Not quite
light,
including
the
obvious, it's not 9, 12, 15.
Michael? Why isn't the object, why isn't the little, oh, the molecular transformer of 8.18? Bag. I'll buy you a drink tonight. Okay, so this is the sort of notion of pipe house. This is actually not a very good example. I'll just talk through it. I mean, this is the object, and this is the diffraction pattern. And the sort of question was, what happens if you block out the center of the diffraction pattern? So this is a high-pass filter, and then what happens if you block out the center and the outside edges? So this is called it's a high and low-pass band pass filter, a band-pass filter. And the example is not particularly good. But basically, you know, you lose the low-resolution information, which are the sort of circles of little dots, and here it gets even worse. Okay, this one is not for the students, so you think you know it all, but, you know, we have to see what the instructors can do now. So, let me pick someone. Vincennes, are you up for this? Would you like to have a go at this, or shall I ask someone? Stand up, I can't hear you actually. Do you want the microphone? Close, keep going. Getting warm. So there's all these, Good. Tall, sampled in the which direction? Tall and sort of sampled. Zebra stripes. Very good. Tall and striped is very good. A figure? Man, this is... A figure? I mean, a drawing or a person? A humanoid? A humanoid with stripes? Like pajamas? humanoid with horizontal stripes. This guy is good. This guy is really good. Anything else? Any more comments? Yay! Just one more slide. Okay, this is the midterm. No, I'm not kidding. So I've given you, this is for your entertainment. But it's kind of fun. So here are some objects and diffraction patterns. The first page is easy. So all you have to do is match the object with the diffraction pattern. Second page is a little more difficult. Again, or second and third page, a little more difficult. So match the object and the diffraction pattern, and you can fill in the answers whenever you feel like it. Okay, that's it. I'll give you the handout for the little test at the end. Any questions that Michael will answer? Because I don't know anything more. So the question is, if you have both high and low resolution data that you've collected in the microscope, can you sort of boost the high resolution data to sort of emphasize the details in your map? Basically when people say that they're applying a B-factor correction, that's essentially what they're doing. So they're just sort of, rationally boosting the high resolution data a certain amount. Now you can do that, but you have to watch out for what happens in your map. If you start boosting your high resolution data and you notice peaks coming up where you know there shouldn't be peaks, like outside the boundary of your structure, you know that you're boosting it too much. But if the background remains flat, it's within reason, it's probably a permissible thing to do. Bob Glazer wants to make a comment.
I'd love to ask, because any of the audience might have missed it, but Garland said this morning that using solution experts gathering data and the solution correct. You can do it, but you have to
why in the last figure were there three clusters of diffraction when there was only a single object in the in real space? I actually don't know the answer. He's desperate for these. So everything that's in the center is repeated at the...
I have a question about your double slit.
is there a way to tell from the diffraction pattern whether it's a single helix or a double helix? I think from what I showed there, the answer is no. I think you would need to go to... With the what? You can only tell on the phases? That's right, it would be, in projection it would be real. You can only tell from the phases. How did they figure out it was a double helix, the original DNA? They're not like, they're not as it was drawn here. So basically they wanted it to be a double helix? No, the answer was that actually it came from density measurements. It had to be a double helix because of the density of the objects that they were diffracting, as far as I remember. Is that correct? Yeah. The density told them that there had to be two strands. Like you're saying, you see the crossovers, which look like sort of at low resolution, they look like sort of blobs.